KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, there's no easy way to define the loose conglomerate of anti-racist and anti-fascist groups known as Antifa. Members espouse views ranging from anarchism to socialism, and former Occupy Wall Street organizer and Dartmouth College lecturer Mark Bray has written all about the history and goals of the anti-fascists. He'll join us to discuss his new book, Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook, and talk about Sunday's violence in Berkeley.
Humane people always try to solve problems with as little violence as possible, but I think that we also need to recognize that neo-Nazis and fascists are monstrous, vile human beings, and I'll always stand on the side of those who fight against them.
It's all coming up next, after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Black-clad members of anti-fascist groups, or Antifa, attacked at least five right-wing demonstrators and journalists at a No to Marxism rally in Berkeley over the weekend. The attacks came after President Trump said what he called the alt-left was culpable for some of the violence in Charlottesville, and after violent riots to keep Milo Yiannopoulos from giving a speech caused $100,000 worth of damage at UC Berkeley back in February. In his new book, Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook, historian Mark Bray lays out the group's roots from resisting Hitler and Mussolini in Europe during the 1920s and 1930s to its current resurgence at far-right rallies in the United States. We welcome Mark Bray to the program. Good morning.
Thank you.
We're also going to hear a little later from the Weekly Standard's Mark Hemingway, who has a different perspective on the Antifa movement. But let me begin, Mark Bray, with you by finding out what this movement is. Or is it really a movement? I mean, I know they're certainly opposed to President Trump, to the police, to the state, but they have no platform. They
Indeed.
Have no hierarchy. They have no leader.
Well, it's anti-fascism, as you said, goes back 100 years, but in its modern form really grew out of self-defense groups formed among immigrants and leftists and punks in Britain and Germany in the 70s and 80s, and then in North America into the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. And certainly you're right that there is no sort of board of directors of anti-fascism. It's not a top-down organization, although there is a network in North America called the Torch Network. And really, it does have a platform insofar it is a pan-left revolutionary politics opposed to the far right that not only aims to stop the growth of neo-Nazism and fascism, but promote revolutionary socialist politics. So in that sense, it is a very coherent specific politics or activity of popular self-defense, even though it is dispersed.
But you point out in your book that many of its adherents, many of the people who identify with the group are not necessarily in favor of violence and are ordinary people. And you have somebody like Noam Chomsky, for example, you know, an icon of the left, saying this is a minuscule fringe of the left. And it's a major gift, by the way, he adds to the right.
Yeah, well, I would encourage Noam Chomsky, and I'd encourage listeners, that regardless of their perspective on the issue, to check out the history I lay out in the book, because there are quite a few documented cases, both in Europe and North America, of small neo-Nazi and fascist groups being successfully thwarted by anti-fascist organizing, not necessarily, of course, through confrontation, sometimes through doxing, where the private information of leaders is made public and they are discredited, sometimes through infiltration and spreading disinformation among the groups. There are a lot of tactics in the anti-fascist playbook that don't entail confrontation, though, of course, confrontation receives the most attention.
Well, in fact, you point out that they also emphasize bringing to light people who are identified with different movements, also having discourse with them when that's appropriate, shaming them, I suppose, maybe even converting them.
Well, yeah, that has happened, and I've spoken to a number of anti-fascists who have explained that through the constant pressure of anti-fascist organizing, a number of fascist and neo-Nazi leaders over time, especially if they have families, if they're having trouble finding employment because they've been blacklisted, will come to the anti-fascists and essentially wave a white flag. And some groups, such as some groups in Denmark and Scandinavia, have created sort of exit programs for fascists to essentially prove that they're no longer part of the movement and be vouched for in a way to reclaim their position in civil society.
The majority, though, would be nonviolent. In fact, at the Berkeley rally, the majority there were peaceful over the weekend. But who are the people who are out there with helmets and black masks and clubs and in some cases weapons who President Trump is saying or trying to say they're as bad as those on the right? I mean, are these the same kind of you talk about lineage, and I want to get into that more with you, but are these same kind of philosophy that we saw among the weathermen in the 60s, breaking windows and just doing destruction rampantly and arbitrarily?
Okay, so in terms of comparing them to the Weather Underground or some of the sort of armed struggle groups of the 60s and 70s...
Well, I'm also asking about the Black Bloc. Yeah. Who are they tied to this whole movement?
Right. So the Black Bloc certainly has a different kind of political lineage from the Weather Underground and some of the groups that you mentioned, although there is some element of overlap. The Black Bloc grew out of the 1980s in Germany when the autonomous movement had to defend itself against police repression for the squatting movement, and later into the decade when it had to confront a neo-Nazi backlash that grew after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and in coalition with Turkish and other immigrants defend itself as this kind of nationalist xenophobic craze was unleashing itself. And so today we can see that in North America and in much of Europe, the Black Bloc tactic of dressing uniformly in black clothes, covering one's face and concealing one's identity in the interest of anonymity is an important street method to prevent repression from state authorities and from the far right. And of course, undergirding this method is an illiberal politics of confronting the far right and essentially taking it as seriously as one would have or should have taken Mussolini when he was rising to power in the beginning of the 20th century.
Well, as you point out, the roots not only go back to confronting Mussolini, but Franco, Hitler, I mean, fascists,
indeed.
Essentially.
Indeed.
And are there links to the present movement and other movements on the left, for example, Black Lives Matter?
Certainly, some of the main principles of anti-racism and racial justice are shared by anti-fascist groups, Black Lives Matter, the immigrant rights movement, and all sorts of social justice movements. There are people, of course, who participate in various different groups along these lines without us necessarily knowing it. But, you know, what we're seeing is that there's so much focus on anti-fascism specifically, and some people are missing the creation of a broader movement against the far right for racial justice that believes in direct action tactics and denying fascism a platform to organize. And that's really the big story, is these coalitions and this broader perspective defending the progress of racial justice movements.
We should mention, and Mark Bray is with us by phone, author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. He's a lecturer at Dartmouth. You call yourself a partisan. You identify with the group. You have a history in Occupy. But also, didn't the president of Dartmouth kind of say you support violence and their methods and kind of call you out on this?
So what happened is a week ago, the right-wing pseudo-media called Campus Reform reached out to the president for comment, and he issued a very oversimplistic and decontextualized statement on my position without checking in with me or the department. And in response, more than 120 Dartmouth faculty have signed a letter of support defending my academic freedom. And so that's sort of, as you can see in the Washington Post, for example, this morning, that's the story as it stands right now. We're hoping to hear some clarification from President Hanlon soon about this matter.
There was also a column that Ben Shapiro wrote. He was one of the people who's come under scrutiny as possible speaker at UC Berkeley, and there was opposition to him because he was high up at Breitbart. National Review, he said, and he's a controversial speaker because he's on the right, but he said a lot of what Antifa represents is the normalization of political violence. It's wrong, even if it's aimed, and I'm using his language now, at bigots or cretins or thugs, as opposed to identifying Antifa almost romantically the way some like Chris Cuomo or Jeff Goldberg have with those who are charging Normandy in World War II. I'd like your comment on Ben Shapiro's point of view here, that in other words,
indeed.
This is maybe normalizing violence and giving it a kind of romantic spin, too.
An important issue to address. So I guess there's two parts to my answer. The first is we can see, especially through the example of Black Lives Matter, that unfortunately violence is part of our society. We live in an incredibly violent society when we look at the role of police in killing black people in the prison industrial complex and so forth. So that's sort of the irony of all of this, is that actually most anti-fascists are police and prison abolitionists and are trying to work for a society that is so much less violent than the mainstream perspective. But the other part of it is that the goal of anti-fascism is to prevent fascist violence from getting out of control in a way that created some of the worst atrocities in human history. And there is a documented lineage that I show in my book of anti-fascists stopping the growth of fascist organizing before it can even get off the ground, before they can even have meetings, before they can even devise plans. And so certainly this is a politics of self-defense. It has a historical lineage. It has an ethical and political framework. And its goal is to try and prevent the kinds of atrocities that we saw grow in the beginning of the 20th century. The fact of the matter is that for people who have no choice but to defend themselves, they live in an illiberal state of affairs. They are experiencing this kind of violence, and self-defense is the argument in response.
The argument, if I can sort of paraphrase it or
Indeed.
Crystallize it, goes mm-hmm. back to the idea that in light of the cruelty and violence of slavery and of the Holocaust, violence, even as at least an option against white supremacists or neo-Nazis, is justifiable.
Well, I think that most people would agree that it was legitimate back in the 1930s to take up arms against the Nazi government, right? The question is, and we all must answer this question, is how bad does it have to get for self-defense to be legitimate? And reasonable people will come up with widely different answers to that question. But it is worth taking that into account when we understand that the anti-fascist answer is you do what is necessary. You do what is absolutely necessary, and not more than that, to stop it before it even gets to that point.
So why, for example, do in the Berkeley, it wasn't a melee for the most part. It was peaceful this past weekend, fortunately. But Antifa members were attacking the press. Our own reporters were attacked and saw fellow journalists beaten by Antifa members on Sunday in Berkeley. Why is that okay?
Well, I wasn't there, and I don't know the details of that, so I can't comment on it too thoroughly, but I can explain the rationale for why anti-fascists do not want to be photographed, and that has to do with being identified in public, possibly facing legal repercussions, possibly facing harassment and threats from the far right. So that is why they don't want to be identified and photographed. And regarding the sort of larger situation in Berkeley, it seems incumbent upon us to recognize that also the main organizers of the counter-protests thank the anti-fascists for showing up and defending the rally and essentially encouraging in a very strong way the far right provocateurs from leaving.
Well, does identifying with the anti-fascist movement require that you accept violence? I mean, can you believe in the principles without embracing violence or seeing violence as a necessity?
I think that people of good conscience can disagree about how to fight back against the far right. I think that anti-fascism is fundamentally, though, a politics of solidarity and unity. That doesn't mean that everyone needs to agree on everything, but I think that the focus is let's find common ground and work together to push back the far right. I think the main principles are really no platform for fascism, which entails not seeing fascism as a difference of opinion, but as a political threat against humanity, and that kind of solidarity and cooperation.
But you realize, of course, and again, you call yourself a partisan, that this can be, of course, used and really was used in Charlottesville by President Trump as a way of saying, look, both sides are bad, including the left.
Well, I mean, so as you mentioned at the outset, I was involved with Occupy Wall Street back in 2011. And if we compare the political climate of the left from Occupy when we were sitting around in circles twinkling our fingers to today when we're discussing the legitimacy of self-defense against Nazis, we can see the kind of escalation that's happened. And even back in 2011, there were similar kinds of arguments when there were, quote unquote, clashes with the police that you see there are these disruptive leftists trying to make trouble. And so it seems that regardless of the context, that's something that's always thrown at us. And historically, fascist demagogues have always portrayed themselves as the victim, even when they've taken power. So the focus for anti-fascists is on self-defense. And you know, what President Trump says is sort of out of anyone's control at this point.
We're talking about Antifa with Mark Bray. He's the author of a book called Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. And there are roots to the Black Panther Party here, too, aren't there, as well as left-wing
Correct.
Paramilitaries in Weimar Germany, as you point out, but also even more contemporarily, some of the movements that we saw in the 80s and right through 2000, the so-called Anti-Racist Action Network, yeah?
Right. So certainly there is a long lineage of self-defense against white supremacy in North America going back to Columbus and the start of slavery. And so, you know, we shouldn't focus exclusively on the specific framework of anti-fascism, but recognize that there's a longer, wider conversation around self-defense and decolonization. But in the sort of self-identified, specifically militant anti-fascist tradition, we can trace its American origins to the creation of anti-racist action, starting in the late 80s out of Minneapolis, primarily among anti-racist skinheads. Of course, there's a popular misconception that skinheads were originally racist. In fact, they were not. They grew out of a sort of blending of cultures from Jamaica and Britain. And so these anti-racist skinheads helped create anti-racist action. And by the 90s, it grew into a large network across North America and even Latin America that had hundreds of chapters and worked not only on pushing back against fascist groups, but also protecting reproductive rights and other kinds of organizing. And today's Antifa essentially are a continuation of that legacy.
Yeah, you even mentioned the Chinese against Japanese imperialism. That's a big picture you're presenting in your book. But you say the oldest Antifa group goes back to Rose City and in Portland, up north of us in Oregon.
Of the currently existing groups, right?
Of the current groups, right. But they were criticized, again, for focusing too much on small groups. And essentially the argument is history teaches us small groups become big groups, as happened in Germany and so forth.
Unfortunately, we can see that Mussolini's initial fascist nucleus had 100 members that when Hitler first attended his first meeting of the German Workers' Party before he turned it into the Nazi Party, it had 54 members. And so the question that anti-fascists raise is, considering it's happened before, considering that we know that history does not always only move upward, but things can get worse, what can we do to try and stop a threat before it even materializes? And that is the tragic irony of militant anti-fascism, is that inevitably, there have been murderous movements that they have stopped before they could get off the ground, but we'll never know that. And in fact, that is a good thing, in my opinion.
Well, I mentioned Oregon, and Mark Hemingway has been following this since he was in college in Eugene, Oregon, when the Black Bloc was being whipped up and the movement was somewhat more nascent. Mark Hemingway is a senior writer with the Weekly Standard, and he's with us on the phone here. Mark, good to have you. Welcome.
Glad to be back.
I guess the real question for you is, you see this as kind of a form of insanity. Why?
Well, I just think that, you know, clearly we are seeing evidence of, you know, widespread violence from this group, and it is clearly escalating. And I think it's really only a matter of time before people start getting killed. I mean, they had one of these free speech rallies up in Portland just a few months ago, and they, for instance, they arrested you know, some members of the, you know, Black Bloc Antifa on a roof nearby with a bag full of bricks. Now, if you're hurling bricks into a crowd from above, you might as well be firing a gun into the crowd. And I don't think that the cops and everyone else treat this as a legitimate violent threat the way they would coming from groups with different political ideologies. And I don't quite know why that is, but I think people need to wake up. I mean, this has been something that has, you know, been simmering for decades. It has always been associated with violence in one form or another, and it's only a matter of time before, at the rate of spreading and the intensity that's been acting out as of late, before very bad things start happening in the name of Antifa.
So your position is there's really no legitimate reason behind saying, for example, a white supremacist, a Ku Klux Klan member, a Nazi should be punched or should be violently assaulted despite their views?
Absolutely. I mean, if someone is demonstrating peacefully, they have a right to, you know, practice to say their views, regardless of how insane and disgusting and awful and racist I might personally find them. Because the moment you start sanctioning, you know, violence on people simply because of their views, things are going to get out of control. I mean, for instance, we see a lot of people in this country that are labeled racist, particularly on the right, that are not racist in any way, shape, or form. I mean, Mitt Romney was racist. The Washington Post wrote a story about how Mitt Romney's campaign in 2012 was using a KKK slogan. I mean, this is absurd. And if you start running around just redefining, you know, who is KKK and who is racist at the same time you're saying violence against people who are racist is legitimate, you're going to cause widespread political violence against people where it is not at all justified.
Mark Hemingway with us, senior writer for the Weekly Standard. What's your reading on Charlottesville then?
Well,
particularly in light of President Trump saying, you know, violence from both sides or many sides is what he said.
Well, I mean, he was not wrong. There were violence on both sides. I mean, having said that, that doesn't mean that I don't think that the counter-protesters, you know, who may have engaged in violence might, you know, are maybe less immediately threatening in some respects than the racists and KKK types that were there. But I think also a big part of the thing that people need to remember here is there's a lot of the media frenzy has left people the impression that there is this, you know, huge and growing, you know, white nationalist KKK movement. And I don't see that's the case. In fact, they identified a lot of the people that were at that KKK rally or white nationalist rally And there are only a few hundred people to begin with. A lot of them are already nationally known racist figures that, you know, people, you know, different groups have been keeping tabs on. So I just don't see a lot of evidence that this is a growing threat, although obviously I'm concerned any time white nationalists and the KKK get together in any, you know, numbers at all.
So how do you stop racists and fascists and white supremacists? What do you do? What's the best method as you see it?
Well, I absolutely think demonstrations, you know, and counter demonstrations are a good thing. I think showing up in force is showing to show people that their views are not, you know, acceptable, you know, or represented in the majority is great. I just don't think that those counter protests should in any way condone violence or should, you know, turn violent or be allowed to get out of control such that, you know, violence happens.
Mark Hemingway, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate hearing your point of view. And again, Mark Hemingway is senior writer with the Weekly Standard. We're coming up on a break, but Mark Bray, I'd like to get your response to what you heard Mark Hemingway put forward.
Sure. I mean, so the question is, how bad is the threat? And reasonable people will disagree about how bad the threat of far-right violence is. But do we want to wait for it to be obviously terrible, or do we want to try and act against it now? That's number one. And number two is, even if you show up to protest peacefully, as most people did in Charlottesville, the police cannot be relied upon to consistently protect us. And the role of anti-fascists in Charlottesville, protecting clergy, protecting nonviolent protesters, has been well documented.
Well, I'm reading a comment here from a listener named Aldred who says, I never thought in my worst nightmare I would ever agree with Fox News talking head Sean Hannity, but like Hannity, I completely agree. The Antifa are thugs cloning the very people they say they're fighting. Fascists, once the creation of Hitler's Germany, if they're not brought down, they could destroy the peaceful movements.
Well, you know, so the question is, when, as we keep coming back to it, what do we do when we are being physically attacked by fascists? What do we do when fascists start to gain access to the halls of power, when they develop a popular movement? It's really kind of a reasonable argument to put forward that maybe we should try and nip this in the bud from the beginning. That involves overwhelmingly nonviolent methods, but self-defense, as we've seen in Charlottesville, has to be on the table to protect people. Heather Heyer paid the price for the violence of the far right, and people that are harping upon the potential violence of anti-fascists are missing that there's been very real murder, both in terms of Jeremy Christian in Portland and in terms of Heather Heyer's murder in Charlottesville. And to me, that clearly is the problem.
Although Todd Gitlin, who was identified with the Weathermen back in the 60s, now a professor.
Well, identified with SDS.
Exactly. Mm-hmm, right. But he was talking about over 70% or 80% of the political motivated killings come from the right. He pointed that out and said, you know, maybe none have been killed yet. Heather Heyer, of course, terrible tragedy. But it's all a matter of time, as Mark Hemingway said.
Well, I mean, the other thing to look at is, like, I am not encouraging anyone to take those methods whatsoever. The goal is to try and resolve this with as least confrontation as possible. So I shouldn't be misunderstood. But I will say that when we look at any kind of violence, you need to look at the context and you need to look at the role of self-defense and not simply look at it in terms of numbers, but look at it in terms of politics.
All right. And we are coming up on a break, and I want to get you, our listeners, involved in this. Let me give you the toll-free number to join the program, and you can certainly let us know what your opinions are and raise any questions and concerns you have. Toll-free number to call, 866-733-6786. And we do welcome your calls and invite you to call in now, 866-733-6786. Or join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or by going to our website and posting questions or comments there, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. But by all means, feel free to join the program. Mark Bray with us, author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. He's also a lecturer at Dartmouth College. You're listening to Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about Antifa with Mark Bray, who's the author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. He's also a lecturer at Dartmouth. And we do welcome your involvement in the program. You can indeed join this conversation with any questions or comments you might have. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum. Just wondering, Mark, since you were involved in the Occupy movement and now have been certainly not only a scholar of, but associated with and learning a great deal about through contact, the Antifa movement, Occupy has sort of disappeared. I have a book in progress, and I had to go back to it after about a year and realize there were a lot of things about Occupy that just didn't hold that much water anymore, kind of off the news shelf, if you will. Is this a movement that you expect will grow? I mean, Todd Gitlin, for example, in the article that he did in the New York Times, suggested it's going to grow and probably has grown since Charlottesville. Or like Occupy, is it bound to maybe not grow so much, even decline?
Well, in the short term, I think it's clear that it's growing. A lot of the groups that I spoke to for my book were formed either during Trump's campaign or after his election over the last few years. But we can see historically that the growth and the rise and fall of anti-fascist movements often has everything to do with the rise and fall of fascism, that this is an activity of self-defense which would not be nearly as prominent if it weren't for the perceived threat from the far right. And the people that are part of these groups are also trade unionists, environmentalists, and activists in a wide variety of circumstances. And the irony of this is that although they are being maligned by some when they participate in anti-fascist groups, when they're doing other kinds of work, they're being praised. And so I think we need to recognize anti-fascists as members of our community, coworkers, neighbors, teachers, doctors, you know, people that are bagging our groceries. It's a variety of people. And so we'll see how it grows, in part depending on what the far right looks like. If anti-fascism is successful, then at a certain point, its rationale will decline. But either way, we can see that anti-fascism as a movement has in its modern form existed for several decades and in its larger form for a century.
But who decides who's a fascist? I mean, it's pretty transparent and easy when you're talking about Mussolini or Hitler or guys dressed in white robes, but they can get it wrong, in many instances probably do.
Well, I mean, the irony is that it wasn't even always clear with Mussolini. I mean, early on, Mussolini had a lot of popular support. A lot of people thought he was a bulwark against the Bolshevik Revolution. They thought he was trying to bring order to society. So the notion that it's clear at the moment who the political enemy is unfortunately not true. If it had been truer back then, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation. But we can also see that anti-fascist groups, of course, don't only organize against textbook fascists. They organize against the far right, anti-Semites, Islamophobes more broadly. But I think that it's pretty clear that the allegation that there's this inherent slippery slope by which anti-fascism inevitably slides into targeting the next most far right groups, into conservatives, into liberals and so forth, is a slope that actually has not really in any substantive way been slid down over the past century. Because what happens, as I mentioned, is that once a local neo-Nazi or fascist threat is successfully defeated, a lot of these groups tend to dissolve or focus on other kinds of organizing. And I think that if you speak to your average anti-fascist, they have a much clearer understanding of what fascism is, how it relates to other forms of far-right politics, than your average armchair pundit.
Here's a listener who says, suppressing the free speech of others by means of organized threats or acts of violence sounds like fascism to me. Self-defense does not include preemptive attacks on others.
Well, I mean, so the question is, what is fascism? Well, fascism is defined by a wide variety of facets having to do with its ultra-nationalism, its promotion of the nation and the race in a perceived social Darwinian struggle for survival, its cult of personality, its masculinity, its fetishization of violence. There's a broad variety of topics. So,
yeah, there's a lot of hyper-masculinity in the Antifa movement, too, isn't there? I mean, it came up yesterday in a discussion we had. Yeah.
Well, but that's part of the question is violence, is self-defense inherently masculine? Because we can see that there are also in Europe Fantifa groups, which are feminist and queer Antifa groups. So we can see that there are a lot of women and queer and trans people involved. So this isn't just sort of your former football players going out there to confront the far right. It has actually a very nuanced gender politics and a perspective on sexuality that is entirely different from the masculinity of fascism, which seeks to return to a traditional patriarchal order. So the point I was making is that we can see that there's a lot of facets to fascism. And what tends to happen is in Western culture, fascism is taken away from being a political identity towards being a personal moral failing, like we see like with a soup Nazi or a grammar Nazi. But it's not just a personal failing, and it's not just based on sort of being mean or being, shutting down someone else, but it's a political identity, a political concept. And the most successful resistance to it in history has been illiberal, even if we look at, for example, the tanks and airplanes that it took to defeat it in World War II.
Talking about Antifa with Mark Bray, the author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook, and it is a book that includes some tactics and all of that. Here's Brian, who tweets, widespread violence, do me a solid and let us know when Antifa has killed someone in the past decades. And another tweet on the other side from Craig, who says, your guess is being disingenuous when he claims Antifa are only defending against racists. Since when are shop windows racist? Let me bring our callers into this. Let's go, Jenny, to you first. Jenny, you're on.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I was at the Berkeley rally on Sunday. I saw the anti-Saws there, and I thought they were really coordinated and organized. I thought that they helped to de-escalate some of the skirmishes that kind of happened. There weren't a lot of, like, right-wing protesters there to really cause the trouble. But when I got home and watched the local news, it seemed like there was, like, an all-out riot that happened, and that didn't really happen at all.
You think, Judy? Thank you for that. Jenny, thank you for that. You think, Mark, that the media has been too hard on Antifa?
Well, certainly there's been a range of coverage, and I've actually been surprised that there has been some reasonable coverage, which is often not the case about far-left politics. But what happens, and this happens with Occupy, this happens with every social movement, is the media is fascinated by conflict. It focuses on conflict in order to be able to demonize it. So it's this kind of irony where it loves it in order to hate it. And certainly with anti-fascism, despite my efforts and the efforts of others to demonstrate that the physical confrontation of white supremacists and neo-Nazis is but a small fraction of the larger issue and is undergirded by a historical and ethical framework, it has often been portrayed as sort of this random thought experiment put into effect by disenfranchised kids who are looking for a thrill instead of part of a century-old movement.
Another caller, Tom, joins us. Tom, you're on.
Well, good morning. While I appreciate the historical context your guest explains about the how to prevent the rise of Nazism and especially the admonition of trying to nip it in the bud early, I do wonder about the question of violence. I understand the right-wing militias in this country are heavily armed with automatic battlefield-grade weapons. So, I mean, is the Black Flag thinking about arming that way? I mean, where does this stop? And I understand that the Trump supporters come in all shapes and sizes and gender and ages. What if a little old granny march along with the right-wingers? I mean, does she get beat up too? You know, can we talk to these people, or is that the only solution?
Yeah, Mark Bray.
Sure. Well, the kind of the ironic thing about this, given American gun laws, is that the kind of anti-fascist formations like Redneck Revolt and others that do open carry at demonstrations, that's probably the most obviously illegal form of anti-fascist organizing in the country because in states with open carry laws, that is a protected right. But we can see that with most Antifa groups, firearms are not part of their current repertoire, and they seek to end conflicts that could potentially arise in a much more dangerous way before they've gotten to that point. But
isn't
I mean,
it more likely, excuse me, Mark, that you're going to have more armed clashes, especially in open carry states?
Well, so the question is, what do you do if you have armed white supremacists? And that's been a problem and a question not only now, but through for the past several centuries. And figures like Ida B. Wells and others have talked about the legitimacy of arming themselves in self-defense against white supremacists. I'm not telling anyone what to do, but I am pointing out that we need to look at this question politically in terms of a conflict between people who want to create a white ethnostate and those who want to prevent that and see that within the larger context. And the question that we keep coming back to is, how bad does it have to get? How threatening does the prospect of white supremacy have to be for people to defend themselves? And we'll all come up with different conclusions for that. But in my book, I lay out the historical and theoretical underpinnings of what these people are saying.
Well, there's a big question looming here. In fact, my colleague John Sepulveda wanted to know if it's okay for those who like the Antifa philosophy to be violent. Is it okay for people who are opposed to it to target Antifa for acts of violence? And presumably, that would lead to the possibility of arms. If you've got Ku Klux Klan members carrying weapons, Antifa might feel beholden, shall we say, or it behooves them to have weapons.
Well, once again, the point that anti-fascists make and the point that I'm making is that it doesn't really make sense to look at political tactics in isolation of the values and politics behind it. So it is very different to talk about the kind of self-defense that Ida B. Wells, for example, or that Malcolm X was talking about versus violence from a Klansman, right? You could talk about a situation where they're both describing doing the exact same thing, but it means entirely something different in the larger historical political context. And so that's all I'm trying to encourage people to do here, is to think about fascism and anti-fascism within a political context. And we can still disagree about what is legitimate or illegitimate, but to simply reduce it to what's being done and without why is to be missing the point.
Charles writes, will Mark Bray acknowledge the fact that Antifa was created by communists not only to fight fascists but to spread communism, and admit that communism and fascism are both, I'm looking at, he says left-wing ideologies. I don't know that they're both left. I think it's maybe more what Susan Sontag said. They're both ideologies, period. Yeah. Or extreme ideologies.
Yeah, well, I mean, some historians would even debate whether fascism is an ideology, but that's for another show. So I will admit, yes, in fact, it's not a matter of admitting. I wrote a book about the fact that the early anti-fascists were communist, socialists, and anarchists. It's an explicitly anti-capitalist revolutionary politics. So I'm not hiding that. I wrote a book about that. But the notion that some right-wing people are pushing that fascism is of the left is entirely groundless historically.
Let me go back to our callers, but before I do, I'd mentioned Todd Gitlin a couple of times and wondered what your thoughts were about, again, a point that he makes. He says Antifa is using violence to intimidate both not only political opponents and those on the left as well who promote nonviolence, and pointed out that violent acts committed by a few will almost always hijack the narrative of the entire protest, and that's happening now and should be no surprise.
Well, I'm not sure what examples he's thinking of anti-fascist attempting to intimidate nonviolent protesters. I'm not familiar with that. I would have to hear more from Dr. Gitlin about that. But the question of the narrative is an important question, and it goes to show you that this is a discussion that has existed for decades outside of the question of anti-fascism specifically. How can more direct action-oriented tendencies coexist with pacifist tendencies and other kinds of tendencies? And there's been a lot of debates about this, and that debate will not be resolved anytime soon. But the anti-fascist perspective is, let's try and stand on the same side of this issue. Opposing Nazism and white supremacy should be a very easy sell, and we can come up with ways to coexist without tearing each other down and turning inward. And really, you know, the other argument is that this comes out of a revolutionary politics that is not primarily based on public opinion polls. It is primarily based on effectively stopping the advance of the far right.
And we'll go to more callers. Let me go next to Karen. Karen, join us.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Well, I've been a criminal defense attorney for 30 years, and self-defense does not apply to people who are only talking. What makes this country great is free speech. What makes this country different is free speech. The places he's talking about, they don't have free speech. They don't have a very, very long tradition of making change with talking, writing, and voting. And, you know, beating up people who are only talking is a look that does not wear well.
Karen, let me thank you for that and go right to Mark Bray on it, because the argument you hear is hate speech cannot be allowed and should not be allowed. You do hear that from many in the Antifa movement, and therefore you attack hate speech directly.
Well, a couple of points. One is that actually one of the most important countries in the history of militant anti-fascism is the United Kingdom, which has an even older history of talking about change through the ballot box and free speech in the United States, yet it is rather popular there. And the other thing is that when we're talking about what self-defense is, anti-fascists do not feel beholden by what a legal definition of anything would be, really, because they are revolutionaries and anti-capitalists. So they have a different understanding, and they have an understanding that says that, you know, if we wait for armed neo-Nazis to show up at our door rather than trying to stop them before they become that powerful, that's sort of a warped conception of self-defense from their perspective, because if you can prevent the need for actually having to fight back, that's the ultimate goal. And so, yeah, the larger question is, how serious is the threat? Can we trust in the governmental system to stop it, as we've seen that has failed in the 20s and 30s? Can we trust in the police to protect us right after we've seen with Black Lives Matter that police violence against people of color is quantitatively a larger threat than necessarily self-avowed neo-Nazis? So those are the questions to ask.
And since you mentioned the UK, I ought to put in here the fact that you point out the opposition of the National Front in Britain is also a good example of the lineage of what you're trying to present as the Antifa movement. And let me thank the caller, Karen from Oakland, and go right to San Leandro. Roberta, you're on the air.
Thank you. I appreciate the educational aspect of what your guest is stating. You know, but coming from the generation of Dr. King, and, you know, I think that sharing education and sharing our nonviolent ideas and ideals is important. You know, I believe that Americans are not stupid. I think that a lot of us are not complacent, and becoming involved is very important. Your guest seems to think that, you know, this preemptive nature will not cause anarchy because, as you know, Michael, there are a group of anarchists who like to just come and make it look like whichever side is bad. And to both of your points, you know, the media, not journalists, media, likes to inflame that. And so I think and believe truly that, you know, reaching out and educating everybody is important. And the crux to cutting off what you're speaking, your guest is speaking about, which is being aware and motivate yourself and your community to be aware of what can happen, does happen, and to get motivated to select better people to represent us.
All right. I appreciate hearing from you, Roberta, and thank you for that call. It brings up another question, if I may, Mark Bray, from a listener named Wendy, who says, I might feel differently about Antifa or Black Bloc protesters if they would be unmasked. For all we know, they could be agents provocateurs.
Well, that is an important question. The question is, what is the sort of downside of exposing one's identity doing this kind of work? And you know, as a point of contrast, I interviewed an anti-fascist from Denmark who made that decision to be public about his identity doing this kind of work, and he was assaulted half dozen times. He had his family threatened, and it made his life rather unlivable. So that's the kind of concern that anti-fascists have about exposing their identity to people who have proven to be murderous and violent. So, you know, agree or disagree with the politics, at least understand that there is a very tangible, immediate reason why some people don't expose their identities.
Well, this was so much in the news that a guy up in Colorado who said he was stabbed by an Antifa militant due to his neo-Nazi haircut actually had stabbed himself. He was afraid that the insurance wouldn't cover him. These stories just continue to sort of spin out in the wake of Charlottesville and so forth. And Hector, you were in Charlottesville? Let's put you on the air here. Yeah, hi.
Yeah, I'm from the Bay Area, but I was in Charlottesville. And, yeah, I wanted to actually thank Mark Bray for his, being on the radio talking about this. But also I wanted to say, there was a caller earlier who claimed there was no evidence of a, growing right wing. But I would say that we've been confronting the group Identity Europa in the Bay for about a year, and they were only 20 members. And then in Charlottesville, they had over 200 members. Like, there's a clear organizing effort by fascist groups to, on college campuses to, attract, disaffected white men. And so I think there's clear evidence that there is, in fact, a rise in the ultra-right and fascists.
That's an interesting point, though. When you think about what happened at Charlottesville, and it gets right to the way these organizing tactics are used, which Mark writes about in his book. I mean, Mark Bray, there was an appeal to all kinds of different factions to come in Charlottesville, those who didn't want to see a Confederate soldier displaced as a statue, those who were wanting to set up a white nationalist enclave. I mean, extremes from all over the continuum. And the media, the Internet served as a great tactic to bring these groups together, didn't it?
Right. And that's part of the sort of the fascist anti-fascist struggle. The struggle between these two sides has changed somewhat in the age of the Internet, where both sides can organize more easily through the Internet and also dox each other, which is, of course, revealing someone's personal information in order to make their own life more difficult. And we can see in the wake of Charlottesville that anti-fascists managed to identify a lot of the tiki torch wielding, khaki wearing Nazis. And when they came home, a number of them were fired from their jobs or disowned by their families. So that is really perhaps the most effective method of doing anti-fascist work, is making fascists and Nazis stand behind the hateful things that they say and face repercussions from society.
I wonder what you say to, and let me thank Hector for the call, a listener named Sean who writes, "Sir, what does fascism even mean? I'm 37 years old. I still don't know."
Sure. So, you know, the first thing to say is that historically fascists have adopted and discarded principles more easily than anyone else. So it is a nebulous concept and arguably not even an ideology. But as we said earlier, it grows out of a nationalist response to World War I, to the perceived destruction of traditional values, given the growth of a kind of quote-unquote bourgeois capitalism on one side and a Marxist Bolshevik state on the other, a desire to return to a patriarchal order, a traditional order, through creating a modern-style political movement. And it, you know, focuses on valorization of masculinity, of violence, and an attempt to kind of create a class collaborationist society, uniting both the working class and ruling class. But in practice, the ruling class has always been prioritized in fascist thought. So it is sort of, in certain sense, a constellation of beliefs connected to a certain time and place that has evolved in very strange, disconcerting ways since the 30s and 40s.
Well, some of those lines have become pretty murky. In fact, let me ask you quite directly. I mean, there are people who call Republicans fascists or people who support the GOP and are strongly identified as Republicans or are Republican lawmakers. I mean, so the line becomes not only murky, it becomes, frankly, pretty shiftable.
Well, the scary thing is it's always been murky, because we can see that the number of sort of fascist ideologues in the 20s and 30s in Europe was actually rather small. But what happened is once there was a crisis, a lot of the traditional elites and traditional conservatives threw their lot in with fascist and Nazi parties in an effort to push back what they considered to be the sort of red hordes coming out of Russia. And so the danger is that we need to recognize it's not just a matter of how many white supremacists or neo-Nazis there are in an explicit sense, but what kinds of connections and bonds and alliances they can form with mainstream right parties. And we can see the kind of, you know, an inkling of that danger with the Trump campaign. And so it's incumbent upon Republicans, if they disagree with these people, to clearly denounce them and not show up to demonstrations with them, because it's been appalling to see how the media has covered so many alt-right demonstrations as simply quote-unquote Trump supporters, when a lot of these people have very documented connections to white supremacist organizing. So if you're a Republican and you disagree with them, you need to make that clear and not show up to a demonstration with them.
Here's Erica, who writes, "Violence is a historical fact that must be understood and managed. So far, it seems like Antifa does a good job of managing it." Dan writes, "I understand a show of force. I understand defending yourself. I don't understand destruction of property." Can I get you to respond to that,
Mark?
Go ahead.
Right. So, you know, obviously, I imagine most listeners are thinking about the case of Berkeley when we talk about property destruction in relation to anti-fascism. And, you know, the argument is, once again, that this comes out of a revolutionary anti-capitalist praxis that attempts to increase the social cost and, in this case, the material economic cost of providing space for far-right organizing to occur. And so the argument goes that essentially by making it super costly to have these events happen, they will happen less likely in the future. And we can see that as Richard Spencer has had his events canceled around the country, the rationale given by universities and other hosts is that they cannot provide for the safety. And so we can see how breaking a few windows in Berkeley can have the direct result of canceling events elsewhere in a way that we can debate whether or not is violent or not, because certainly the question of property destruction is significantly different from bodily harm. But that is the rationale, and that's the sort of the result that anti-fascists would point to.
We had the UC Berkeley chancellor on yesterday, Carol Crist, and she was asked directly, and it's still a question that looms, because she's in favor of free speech. When you have somebody like Yiannopoulos and $100,000 worth of damage occurs, who's going to foot the bill, and can that simply be factored into budgetary expenses necessary to support free speech? I'm going to go to another caller. NG joins us next. NG, you're on.
Hi. So I've been part of anti-fascist organizing for a long time. I knew many of the people who were in the Black Bloc at the demos this weekend. And something that frustrates me about the way that liberal media covers these events all the time, and frustrates me particularly about KQED, is they always make this false separation between the so-called peaceful and the so-called violent protesters. Many of those people who are so-called peaceful out there have been part of Black Blocs, have been part of anti-fascist organizing. The medics, a lot of the organizers of the demos, actually publicly came out during a press conference to say that they support Antifa and that they do not apologize to the fascists for coming out and choosing to engage in violence.
So forgive me, JN, you say this is a false dichotomy you think that we set up or the media sets up in general?
Yeah, that and that as a longtime listener to KQED, it really disappoints me that I feel like KQED resorts to these false separations. And I think it's analogous to what has happened in America with the coverage of the far right, actually, of liberal media not being in touch with how Trump supporters came up and how the far right has come up in the U.S. They're also very out of touch with youth, the disaffected, black folks, people of color in general, undocumented, and how more and more people are embracing politics of the far left. And as a liberal person, if you don't like that, I mean, maybe the question should be to stop grouping people into these false separations and start actually engaging with where people are at and why they decide to make the decisions they do to protect themselves and their communities.
Well, Jan, I appreciate hearing from you, and we've got seconds left here. Mark Bray, you want to comment on Jan's comments?
Well, I agree, and I think that also we need to see that how we define violence and nonviolence is historically and politically contextual, and we can even see that back a number of years ago, things like blocking traffic were not clearly understood as nonviolent. Today, in comparison to what we see, they are more understood as nonviolent. It's contextual, it's shifting, and we need to look at the politics and values behind what we do, not simply lump things into a false dichotomy.
Well, we're getting a lot of listeners reminding us of the efficacy of the work of Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi, and they were nonviolent. Violent and they were in favor of civil disobedience, but that has to be seen perhaps in light of what we've been talking about here and ought to be. And thank you, Mark Bray, for talking with us.
A pleasure.
Appreciate it. Mark Bray, again, is the author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. We spoke earlier with Mark Hemingway, senior writer with the Weekly Standard, and we are here with you every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. We remind you that we always appreciate hearing from you, and you can let us know what your thoughts are about future programming we ought to be concerned about or programming in the past by emailing us forum@kqed.org. That programming in the past can be accessed through our archives, kqed.org. Go to forum. And thank you for being with us for these 2 hours this morning. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, back with you on tomorrow. In this hour, by the way, we'll be talking to Frederick Cruz, who has written a book about Sigmund Freud. Very, shall we say, unfavorable and critical book. That's tomorrow at 10. Thanks for being with us today. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.